Now. Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, evolving your passions. We push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
So here's the thing. If it walks like a trade war and it talks like a trade war, it's pretty much a trade war. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday today, the second day of July. Good as always to have you along, everybody. The trade war status update in just a bit, but your daily economic news comes with a dose of geopolitics on this Monday, and it arrives in the form of a couple of acronyms. AMLO is the first one, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, the runaway winner of yesterday's Mexican presidential election. The second is NAFTA. Don't think I need to spell that one out. López Obrador's win comes as NAFTA renegotiations are, one might say, on hiatus, I suppose. So we asked Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson to see how the new guy might affect the state of trade play.
There'd been a big push to try and get these NAFTA revisions wrapped up before these elections. That clearly didn't happen. But just how much the change in Mexican leadership might affect the outcome of these talks is a bit unclear, says Gustavo Flores Macias, a professor at Cornell.
López Obrador, he had been fairly critical of NAFTA over the last several years, but during the campaigns, he moderated his tone.
Macias says both López Obrador and President Trump have nationalist views that may clash with each other. But on the other hand, López Obrador has already appointed a lead negotiator with a pro-free trade background. And Christopher Sands, director of the Center for Canadian Studies at Johns Hopkins University, says he and Trump may actually find some common ground on issues, like raising the minimum wage in Mexico.
Donald Trump would like that because it means that Mexican labor is more expensive. That won't be a big magnet to manufacturers and others to put jobs in Mexico. But López Obrador comes at it the other way. He's a progressive and populist figure who wants to see Mexico's incomes rise.
Still, other sticking points in the talks are likely to remain, like auto and agricultural exports. And while López Obrador didn't run an anti-American campaign, Ian Bremmer with the Eurasia Group says the U.S.-Mexico relationship is nonetheless troubled.
Anyone coming in to the Mexican presidency was going to have a very hard time with the Trump administration, given the nature and the politicization of discussions on trade, on NAFTA, on migration, on the border wall.
Bremmer says it will be easy and tempting for Mexico's new president to score political points by taking a tough stance on those issues. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Not for nothing, but our other partner in NAFTA slapped new tariffs on $13.5 billion worth of American goods yesterday. That is, of course, Canada. And as you're going to hear later, new tariffs against China are going to go into effect on Friday, which gets us to this. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce, not usually opposed to traditional pro-business Republican presidents, is out with a report today on just how the tariffs that are in effect now are going to play out state by state. The big picture, the chamber says, looks like this, and this is a quote. As of this week, approximately $75 billion worth of U.S. exports will be subject to retaliatory tariffs. Escalating tit-for-tat trade actions promise to raise costs on American businesses and consumers, end of quote. So we got on the phone this morning with people at the state level who are watching the whole tariff thing pretty closely. Lori Otto Punk is the president of the Washington State Council on International Trade.
You know, in Washington State, 40% of the jobs are trade related. And so our economy here stands to suffer the most when trade, you know, when there's tariffs and duties and other barriers that really hurt the U.S. relationships abroad, particularly with some of our closest trading partners, Canada, Mexico, you know, the European Union and China.
Greg Canfield, Secretary of Commerce for the great state of Alabama, where automotive parts are the leading export, also very much at the center of the trade war. There's a Mercedes plant in Tuscaloosa, a new Toyota Mazda plant in Huntsville. So Canfield says he has got his work cut out for him.
We need to educate the administration and the U.S. Department of Commerce that there is a potential negative impact to the various states that will ultimately lead to lack of sales, lack of production, rising cost, and ultimately job loss.
We called up Gene Barr, too. He's the president and CEO of the Pennsylvania Chamber of Business and Industry. His office has had a conversation with Hershey, the chocolate people whose products come wrapped in, right, aluminum foil.
Hershey's concern is being largely shut out of the Canadian market, which, again, endangers jobs, you know, right here in central Pennsylvania.
So you take a trade war, which does seem to be a bit beyond the are we really in one yet stage. You roll that in with a sea change election for one of our key trading partners. And what do you suppose happens on Wall Street? Well, what happens is the traders, and not for the first time, get a little agita early on, and then they decide they just don't care. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. It's possible, and one does have to emphasize the possible part here, because Wells Fargo has repeatedly over the past couple of years demonstrated its ability to do the wrong thing. But it's possible that the bank could be in for a bit of a respite from negative headlines. Last week, it passed the Federal Reserve's annual stress test, a test that measures whether companies have enough capital on hand and a strong enough plan in place to make it through the next economic crisis when it comes. Marketplace's Rima Kreis explains what might be in store now for Wells.
This past weekend, when Bert Ely was reading the Sunday newspaper at his kitchen table, he spotted a double-paged ad for Wells Fargo. As an independent financial consultant, he tries to keep up with these things.
I have to admit that I only read the headlines because I know pretty much what I'm going to read.
Ad headlines like Purple Heart Vet gets home donated by Wells Fargo, or Wells Fargo ups donations to more than $1 million a day.
This is part of trying to rebuild its trust with its customers.
These ads, which have been appearing in newspapers and on radio and TV since May, are an attempt to burnish Wells Fargo's image. Jamie Moldavsky is chief marketing officer at Wells Fargo.
And it highlights all of the investments and partnerships we have with our communities.
Since the account scandal came to light, there have been multiple organizational changes, including the CEO stepping down. Meanwhile, earlier this year, the bank agreed to pay $1 billion in fines to settle claims of improper mortgage and auto lending practices. All of that said,
in terms of financial condition, the bank is on very firm footing.
Karen Shaw Petru is managing partner at Federal Financial Analytics. She says passing the Federal Reserve's stress test is a bright spot and makes shareholders happy. But whether the bank will win over customers?
It will depend on whether there are future actions against the bank, any more scandals come out.
Basically, she says Wells Fargo has got to stay out of trouble. I'm Rima Kreis for Marketplace.
One more quick thing before we move on, a new thing that we are doing, me and Molly Wood, a riff on our podcast, which I think I've mentioned before, is called Make Me Smart. If you've got an Alexa, yes, technically an Amazon Echo, but if you've got one, all you got to do is say, Alexa, make me smart, and we will deliver up an explainer, me and Molly, or one of us actually at a time, about the economy, tech, or pop culture. We'll get you a new one every weekday. And remember, you can always ask any smart speaker you happen to have to just play Marketplace. All right, now to a story that caught our attention last Friday about the biggest city in this country and the unintended consequences of gentrification. Lam Thuy Vo is a data journalist with BuzzFeed News. She dug through a bunch of census and New York City data looking for correlation between three data points. The number of calls made to 311, which is the city's non-emergency hotline. Also, changes in property values and demographic changes by specific neighborhood. Lam, it's good to have you on the program.
Thank you.
Tell me, first of all, would you, about this block up in Harlem that you sort of started and centered your research on?
This is West 136th Street. And basically, I crunched, I think it was 17 million 311 complaints in New York City to find this block. Basically, I wanted to see how this kind of phenomenon of permit patty, this idea that people are calling the cops on their neighbors, bore itself out in a neighborhood. And so we found this one block that had seen a dramatic increase of 311 complaints, mostly noise complaints. Mm-hmm. And we wanted to see how it affected the people on that block.
You had these complaints. Tell me, target is too strong a word, but they were calling about, in many instances, a certain set of people.
Yes. So there is this very strong Latino community on West 136th Street. And for decades, they've lived on that block. And whenever the sun comes out in the summer, they would go out and sit in little fold-up chairs and then play dominoes, but also play music. And basically, the whole block would come alive with this very rich, like, New York City-centered stoop culture. Mm. And one of the people that we talked to was a 105-year-old man who had been sitting on that block for about 40 years. And because new people moved in who weren't used to that kind of noise, he had to sort of change how he led his life, right. How a lot of those folks who have lived on that block for a long time led their lives.
Take this from Harlem down through the rest of Manhattan and out into Queens and Brooklyn, because these kinds of things, changing demographics and then the use of 311 and this kind of situation are happening in other parts of the city as well.
Right. So what we wanted to see was, how are gentrification and racial demographics related to 311 calls? And we found 311 complaints. And we found that there was a higher rate per capita of complaints in gentrifying neighborhoods or gentrified neighborhoods. There was also a change, a demographic change, where more white people had moved in. While in all other tracts, the population of white people had gone down. Hmm. So we found that in Brooklyn, in Washington Heights, in Harlem, there was a clear correlation between the high level of 311 complaints and the demographics changing to become more white.
You talked to some of these newcomers. What'd they say?
So we talked to about 30 people on their block. A dozen of them were long-term residents who had been there for 40 years or longer or had grown up on that block. And then we also talked to people who had lived there for, let's say, 1 to 2 years. And those folks were mostly like, oh, yeah, it can be a little loud. I might not feel like I'm part of the community, but I'm not going to call in those complaints. Mm-hmm. And then there were a smaller subset of newcomers. And the people who we found who had used 311 were white. And they were saying that this used to be a bad neighborhood. This used to be a dangerous neighborhood. And I didn't feel like I could approach this person. And so I called 311, who then connected us with the police. Hmm. I think that's where also tensions may exacerbate. Tensions that have maybe existed before. Once you have the cops coming in and telling people to break up the domino games, they start feeling like they've been betrayed. A lot of the residents who had been living there for a long time told us that they had never heard of anyone coming out and being like, oh, okay. Can you tone it down? That kind of communication is what, in essence, makes for a community in a neighborhood, you know?
Lam Tuevo, writing at BuzzFeed News about...
Yes.
well, it's a cool prize. It's data journalism brought to the radio, which I think is kind of cool. Lam, thanks very much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Have a good day.
Coming up,
how all the bits and pieces come together to form, you know, the magic thing that they're doing.
Ah, but then magic meets tariffs. First, though, let's do the numbers. All right, so the blue chips were down 193 early, and then traders said, yeah, whatever. Dow Industrials gained 35 points by the bell, a tenth of 1%, 24,307. The NASDAQ up 57 points, about 0.7%, 75.67. The S&P 500, 8 points to the good, 0.3%, 27.26. Tesla has finally reached its production goal of 5,000 cars per week. Nevertheless, shares off 2.3% because capitalism. Other auto stocks recovered a bit from trade war worries. General Motors gained 0.25%. Ford accelerated almost 0.3% today. Target said it's going to automate some jobs in the face of rising labor costs, including the task of counting the cash generated by its 2,000 stores. irony. Once again, thy name is capitalism. Target down 0.4% today. Bonds fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.87%. You're listening to Marketplace. As a nonprofit news organization, Marketplace is able to do what we do every day thanks to funding from public radio stations, foundations, corporate underwriters, and listeners like you. Thank you to all the Marketplace investors who've contributed over the past year for helping keep public service journalism strong. We appreciate your support.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Let's say you've got a product. It's been around a while, 50-something years. It was once great, now a bit faded, but there is a kernel there that a new guy could build on. Gus Wenner is the new guy that Rolling Stone magazine is counting on, kind of a new guy anyway. His dad, Jan, founded and built the magazine that Gus is trying to bring back. Gus, thanks for coming into the studio.
Thank you very much.
What is it that you are trying to do with this magazine now, man? Which first of all, we have to point out is like twice as old as you are.
That's very true.
So you grew up with it.
I did. I grew up with it. We are trying to evolve it and turn it into a incredibly important brand for today's generation.
Which is interesting because that's what you were for a lot of the 70s and 80s. I mean, your dad built this thing into a cultural force. So give me the thumbnail version of what happened, because it's been a while since you've been, this is going to sound worse than I mean it to, relevant.
I think that he, first of all, what he did is unbelievable. I still feel so fortunate to be in the position that I'm in. And
borrowed $7,500 and built an institution, truly a cultural institution in this country.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that it was founded at a time where music was kind of bursting at the seams and counterculture was in full swing. And he discovered that music could be a very powerful vehicle to enact change in this country. So I think over the years, culture changed. And he, you know, had a very specific worldview, and I think it's kind of ebbed and flowed and remained very important and critical, but in different form and fashion and not right at the center of zeitgeist per se.
It is a different corporate environment now for you and your dad. The magazine has been sold. The operation has been sold. You are employees now of the owners of this company. What does that feel like, and does it change how you do what you do?
It changes in the sense that we were able to find a partner to allow us to capture the once-in-a-lifetime opportunity we have with a brand this meaningful and this powerful. And the last 2 years, I spent pretty much every day getting us to the point where we could find the right partner to focus on this brand. I don't know how much of the backstory you know.
Well, let's go into it a little bit, right? Yeah. Because you are the guy, actually, who drove these sales. Right? The first one to BandLab and then to Penske Media, right?
Yeah. And I mean, it started with selling Us Weekly.
Right.
Then it was selling Men's Journal, which was another magazine we owned. And the philosophy behind it all was those were great magazines, but I just didn't quite see how they could be more than that. And I think to thrive in today's environment, you have to be more than just a magazine.
And now you're betting the ranch on the prime property, basically.
That's exactly right.
He says with a deep breath. The new sort of revitalized Rolling Stone went on sale last week, right?
Yes.
But you got a copy of it?
I do.
Can I take a quick peek? Because I want to talk
about
more
than a quick peek.
All right, I'll take a long peek.
Take a long peek.
It feels different, actually.
It feels very different.
Which we'll get to. So it's Cardi B
and
on the cover. And Offset, a very pregnant Cardi B.
Yes.
So I want to talk about the way this thing feels, but but there is, because it's different. It's heavier paper, and it's just different. But why stay with the printed product in a digital age?
Well, I think that you need to have, if you're a magazine, which is our history and our DNA, and it's not the future of who we are, but it's, I'd say, the foundation of who we are.
Yeah.
It needs to be a great product. And I think for the
An actual physical product.
We want the magazine to be strong. And that's why we took it back to its oversized format.
Yeah.
Almost doubled the sort of quality and thickness of the paper, which you can feel.
Yeah, you can. And it's expensive, right?
I mean, it's expensive.
This cover, this fancy feeling thing cannot be cheap.
It cannot be cheap, no. But we want to put a premium quality product in the marketplace. And I don't think we can truly build great businesses around it unless our core DNA product isn't as strong as it needs to be and should be.
How come you're the guy who's driving this? And how come your dad didn't reach out to somebody, else?
Well, I mean, when I came into the business, the digital piece was very small. It's about...
Right. And you came in to run digital, we should say.
Yeah. I mean, I came in to sort of shadow the chief digital officer at the time. And I didn't come in thinking, I'm going to run this company. I came in thinking, I believe so much in what this thing stands for. It's so a part of who I am and in my opinion, the fabric of culture. In order for it to evolve and succeed, we need to grow our digital property, which we really started doing. And then from there, and my responsibilities grew, became clear we needed to do more than just that.
Gus Winter, president and COO of Rolling Stone. Gus, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
We talk a lot here about how important it is to try to figure out what's really going on in the economy beyond just what you hear or read in the headlines. Mostly we do that with people, how they are getting by in their day-to-day. But there's a corporate corollary that's important, too, specifically now with all the tariff news. This coming Friday, there are new sets of mutually retaliatory tariffs set to kick in, us on Chinese goods and Chinese tariffs on our exports going there. As I said, big news in the headlines, bigger news if it's your stuff being tariffed. Our China correspondent Jennifer Peck has that story from Shanghai.
Right now, a ship from China is gliding across the Pacific Ocean towards the U.S. On board are things like circuit boards and LED lights, part of a consignment order of children's learning kits destined for a New Jersey warehouse for an American tech education startup called Chibitronics.
Hi, this is how you program the Chibi chip.
The firm makes videos and educational tools to help children learn about robotics. This latest shipment should arrive by mid-July, but by then, those goods, categorized as electronic parts, will be subject to tariffs, along with water pumps, nuclear reactors, and cars. Chibitronics co-founder Bunny Huang.
Those are now going to see a 25% cost increase.
Among his options are increasing the price of what he sells to schools or cut pay for his staff. At the same time, Huang says American tariffs on electronic parts make it harder for small tech manufacturers to produce in the U.S.
Every maker who wants to build anything with electronics is going to need a soldering iron. That just got 25% more expensive. Your typical battery that you would need to power your project, all of the little tiny piece parts on the circuit board, like the resistors and the capacitors, got more expensive.
The Trump administration is taking public comments on a second list of planned tariffs on $16 billion worth of imports from China that will be imposed at a later stage. Microchips and plastics for 3D printers could be among the affected items. What U.S. officials haven't put on either list so far are finished goods from China, like TVs and cell phones.
They've essentially saddled Made in America with 25% tariffs, whereas stuff made in China has no tariff. It's really ironic. It seems to be the opposite of what they're trying to achieve.
This second list of tariffs is meant to target China's push to gain dominance in high-tech manufacturing under a plan called Made in China 2025. Chinese economist Hu Xingdou in Beijing says the way the tariffs are applied won't achieve that.
Very few of the products that benefit from this policy will be exported to the U.S. China mainly sends low-end products to the U.S., or assembled products, such as Apple's iPhone.
The Trump administration says the tariffs are about protecting American innovation and jobs. But Bunny Huang, who also advises other startups, says the best way to protect American intellectual property, or IP, is to assemble the products that use that IP in the U.S.
The most critical IP is often added late in the stages of the firmware or the final assemblies, sort of like how all the bits and pieces come together to form, you know, the magic thing that they're doing. If they do that final assembly, the last screw operation in the United States, they actually get really, really strong intellectual property protection because it's all done in the United States, never leaves the shore.
But since the U.S. tariffs target electronic components, Huang says smaller tech firms who have been buying parts from China and producing in America will have to choose between increased costs or producing their goods in a cheaper country and risk losing their intellectual property. He bets that firms will choose to stay competitive and manufacture abroad, perhaps even in China. In Shanghai, I'm Jennifer Pak for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today from the Marketplace desk of We Report, You Decide. Axios had an item this weekend, a proposed piece of legislation from the White House that would give the president broad, and I mean really, really broad new powers to run the American trade economy. It's doubtful it will ever see the light of even a congressional hearing, but since we started with acronyms, we will end with one. The name the White House gave this thing? The U.S. Fair and Reciprocal Tariff Act. Think about it. I know, but I didn't make it up, all right? Don't yell at me. Dow Industrial's up 35 today, about a 10%. NASDAQ gained 57, about 0.7%. S&P 500 up 0.8%. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, and Daisy Palacios. Our special projects desk is Tommy Andres and Haley Hirschman. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our wealth and poverty desk. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.